The views and opinions expressed on Gaza Corner are those of me, Dory, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of KALW Public Media. In May of 2010, a Gaza Freedom Flotilla packed with humanitarian aid led by the Turkish vessel the Mavi Marmara set sail for Gaza from Cyprus. Israeli commandos raided it in international waters, killed 10 on board, 10 humanitarian activists. 9 were Turkish, and 1 was a Turkish-American. That was a tipping point for me. It's often a feeling of kind of like, what can we do? We see genocide in Gaza. We see just senseless killing, and what can we do? In 2010, the raiding of the Mavi Marmara set me off in that kind of frame of mind. And I said, I have one platform, and that's one primary platform, and that's Tangents. And so I was able to create Gaza Corner within Tangents. The very next Saturday, following the Mavi Marmara attack. So it was born, Gaza Corner was born on June 5th, 2010. Next week, a new Freedom Flotilla is scheduled to leave for Gaza. 3 ships are scheduled to leave from Turkey and 1 from Italy. Significant obstacles remain, not least of which is doing everything possible to not have a repeat of the Mavi Marmara tragedy. Humanitarian Relief Foundation, also known as IHH, is the primary organizer of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition and was one of the international NGOs that arranged the 2010 Gaza Freedom Flotilla. IHH is based in Turkey and was designated a terror organization by Israel in 2008. I was kind of curious why that might be. There's a press release linked at the Gaza Corner section of the Tangents playlist, and it goes into detail as to why that terror designation got applied. But to just cut to the chase. In that press release, here's a quote, from Israel's point of view, whoever lives in Gaza is a terrorist, and whoever aids Gaza supports terrorism. Approximately 1,000 people will participate in the journey, along with 100 journalists, and there will be internet and satellite connections. And what is clear from bearing witness to the live stream ongoing genocide in Gaza, Israel will do what it wants, even if the whole world is watching. The Freedom Flotilla will be carrying 5.5 tons of humanitarian aid. And Israel is not the only obstacle in reaching Gaza. Negotiations are still ongoing with Turkish officials, according to a Middle East Eye report, which is linked at the Gaza Corner section. Turkish sources say the Freedom Flotilla will probably get to go, but arriving in Gaza could be a different matter. Some of the hesitancy from Turkey is that it doesn't want to further complicate its relations with Israel, which has seriously deteriorated due to the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Anne Wright, spelled with a W, a former U.S. Army colonel who quit the Army in 2003 due to her opposition to the invasion of Iraq. When reminded of the fate of the Mavi Marmara, she said, quote, in case of such an attack, we'll expect all governments to uphold international law. According to international law, Israel has no right to raid a ship filled with civilians and humanitarian aid, unquote. Israel has a long history of not being held accountable for violating international law. So it continues to just violate it whenever it wants. If the Freedom Flotilla needs to be rerouted, which is a very realistic possibility, Egypt may be its ultimate destination. The tentative departure date, although by no means guaranteed, is April 24th, this Wednesday. I imagine you will be able to track its progress by going to the Freedom Flotilla website, which is freedomflotilla.org. This morning, as I always do, I have a tabletop radio on my kitchen counter and I turned it on. NPR was beginning its 5 minutes of news headlines. I noticed that Gaza was not even mentioned at all. As the genocide continues, according to The Intercept, TV news coverage and internet searches about Gaza have both plummeted. And despite daily mass slaughter in Gaza and a severe escalation of settler violence in the West Bank, it appears mainstream media fatigue is setting in. There are notable exceptions, but none of these are considered Western mainstream media. Al Jazeera, Democracy Now, 972 Mag, Mondo Weiss, and others, including this one, Gaza Corner. Gaza Corner has dedicated every program since the October 7th attack to Israel's war on Palestinians. Did you know that yesterday an Israeli airstrike on a house in Rafah killed at least 10 people, including 6 children? I ask because that should have been one of the stories in the NPR headlines. It should be a front page story in the New York Times, the Washington Post. No, not reported. If that had happened almost anywhere else on earth, it would have made it into NPR's news headlines or front page in most mainstream Western media. But the Gaza genocide is becoming normalized, which to me is itself a crime against humanity. I'll tell you what happened in this airstrike on this home in Rafah, because otherwise I'm not sure you would know about it. And there's a link to the story that I'm about to reference at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist. It's from Al Jazeera. The deaths in Rafah included Abdel Fattah Sobhai Radwan, his wife Najla Ahmed Awada, and their 3 children. According to his brother-in-law, Ahmed Barhoum, he reported those deaths, and he also reported the loss of his wife, Rawan Radwan. Also, their 5-year-old daughter was killed, Ala, A-L-A-A. Barhoum told the Associated Press, as he was crying and gently rocking Ala's dead body, "This is a world devoid of all human values and morals." He went on to say, "They bombed a house full of displaced people, women and children. The only martyrs were women and children." According to Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud, reporting from Rafah, quote, "Their burns were so bad that even if they made it to the hospital alive, they would have quickly lost their lives because there's no way such injuries could be treated right away given the current situation." As I earlier alluded to, Israel's history, including prior to its creation, is littered with war crimes. The sad fact is Israeli war crimes have long been normalized due to the impotence of the United Nations, the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice, and most notably Western nations who provide Israel with impunity. Also normalized are targeted assassinations. Israeli journalist Ronan Bergman, who is the author of Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations, stated in 2018, quote, Israel has used assassination and targeted killing more than any other country in the West. The policy dates back to 1948, September the 17th, when Zionist terrorists killed the Swedish mediator for the United Nations, Count Folke Bernadotte, in Jerusalem. Yitzhak Shamir, who later became Prime Minister of Israel, you can name many Israeli prime ministers who were terrorists prior to becoming prime minister. Yitzhak Shamir played a role in the approval and planning of Bernadotte's assassination. In November 2000, Israel became the first nation state in the world to, quote, openly acknowledge that it operated a policy of targeted killing. This according to Niels Melzer, who served as the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture in 2009. As many of you know, the United States also uses targeted assassinations, likely inspired by Israel's success. Many examples. One notable example was Trump authorizing the killing of top Iranian General Qassem Soleimani. Agnes Callamard, the UN's Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings, ruled, quote, the course of action taken by the United States was unlawful. But we knew that already. Targeted assassinations, unless there is an imminent threat to life, are unlawful. Try telling that to longtime New York Times uber pro-Zionist Israeli supporter Thomas Friedman. He may have surprised people on April 10th with an op-ed titled, Israel, cease fire, get hostages, leave Gaza, rethink everything. But he revealed in the course of that op-ed that he openly advocates for targeted assassinations, in this case, targeted assassinations of Hamas leaders. Quote, going after Hamas's leadership in a targeted way, more Munich, less Dresden. That is a military response akin to how Israel tracked down the killers of its athletes at the 1972 Munich Olympics, and not how the U.S. turned Dresden into a pile of rubble in World War II. So yes, targeted assassinations are normalized. And genocide, the crime of all crimes, has been normalized as well. As long as the United States keeps feeding Israel arms, and another $26 billion is about to be signed into law by Biden, cynically including $9 billion for Gazan humanitarian assistance, while the bill also includes a one-year ban on funding UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, which is the most essential humanitarian aid organization for Palestinians and has been since 1949. No entity can replace what UNRWA does. Even members of the U.S. government admit that. Yet they're banning, really for political theater, a year of support for UNRWA. In essence, the U.S. is funding genocidal attacks with American-made indiscriminate bombs while trying to portray itself as also helping Gazans. I say indiscriminate because 2,000-pound bombs are part of the arms package, and they are intrinsically indiscriminate, as when they land, they create killing for a quarter of a mile distance. Removes entire blocks and kills many, many people. Every week, the Biden administration's complicity in the ongoing genocide in Gaza grows deeper. Beyond the billions more in military aid that will be signed into law imminently, even more significant news transpired that many of you probably are not aware of because, in my opinion, self-censorship at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and NPR is not reporting it, even though it was widespread information throughout Middle Eastern mainstream media. So what I'm referring to are multiple sources, such as Al Arabi, Al Jadid, and the Qatari newspaper, the New Arab, Israeli newspapers, the Jerusalem Post, the Times of Israel, and Israel's Haaretz. All of them reported that the United States approved a potential Israeli Rafah invasion in exchange for Israel agreeing to not launch a widespread attack inside Iran. This news broke on Thursday, and Israel complied by launching a soft deterrent strike inside Iran that killed nobody. Although in a separate strike that same day, one member of Iraq's pro-Iranian popular mobilization forces was killed, and eight were wounded in an explosion at a military base south of Baghdad in Iraq. More than half of all Gazans are in Rafah. It's the last place they could go to. Close to 1.5 million people living in horrid conditions. Axios reported U.S. officials denied reports that Biden administration gave a green light for an operation in Rafah. Now, there's no way the U.S. would publicly acknowledge that this quid pro quo deal with Israel happened. In fact, in early March, President Biden warned of a quote-unquote red line for Israel over Rafah. A red line, but apparently Biden's red lines are subject to change, and they can turn green. But Israel had lots of leverage because Biden's priority above all is to avoid an all-out war in the Middle East with Iran and its proxies. And so Biden saw giving into Netanyahu's invasion of Rafah as a satisfying, as I say, quid pro quo. According to two Gaza war monitors, the Institute for the Study of War, ISW, and the Critical Threads Project, CTP, the United States and Israeli officials held a high-level, quote-unquote, virtual meeting on Thursday to discuss a Rafah invasion. Quoting from the Al Jazeera article that's linked at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist, the United States-based think tanks said Israel shared with the United States its plan to move some 1.4 million Palestinian civilians out of Rafah ahead of its promised ground invasion. However, the plan did not include, quote, concepts for access to food, water, and other civil services. Al Jazeera's Abu Azoum said Rafah has been witnessing a surge of Israeli military strikes the last couple of weeks, and these attacks could be seen as a sign that a military incursion, a major one, could be carried out soon. And this is especially true in light of Israel's mobilization of its troops near the border with Rafah. Additionally, there were Israeli strikes just earlier today, yesterday as well, on other areas of the Gaza Strip, including the Jabalia, the Nuseirat, Makazi, and the Berej refugee camps. Al Jazeera has correspondents on the ground in Gaza. They've had them there since the beginning of the war. Many are Gazans themselves. Israel does not let international reporters into Gaza unless they agree to be embedded with the IDF and then to be subject to censorship from the IDF. Haaretz analyst Zevi Barel, he wrote a detailed piece that really digs into this topic, and it's also linked at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist. It's titled, Israel's Response to Iranian Attack Impacts Legitimacy of an Operation in Rafah, subtitled, According to reports, Egypt and the Palestinian Authority have already accepted the fact that Israel will enter Rafah and have begun preparations for absorbing the displaced and managing civil affairs. To quote the article, according to an Egyptian source, Israel has already notified Egypt of its intention to conquer Rafah and has begun to attack open areas along the Philadelphia route, separating the Gaza Strip from Egypt, where tunnels connecting Gaza to Sinai are suspected to exist. The source was able to say that the plan rests on, quote, dividing Rafah into four quarters, which will be conquered sequentially, so that the residents of each quarter will be forced, when their turn comes, to flee to a different area. The Qatari report noted that Egypt is exemplifying, quote, full readiness and preparedness of its forces stationed in northern Sinai along the 14-kilometer border strip of the Gaza Strip as part of a plan to deal with the scenario of a ground invasion in Rafah. In other words, Gazans may be ethnically cleansed into a giant tent city in the Sinai. Barrell reports that Egypt has apparently accepted the conquest of Rafah and is expediting preparations for absorbing the evacuees by building another tent camp, this one in Khan Yunis, in addition to two camps already built and managed by the Egyptian Red Crescent, which can jointly house 11,000 dispossessed. Remember, there are about 1.4, 1.5 million people in Rafah. The news site Rai Al-Yum reported this week that Egypt has deployed forces along the Egyptian side of the Philadelphia route and defined a quote-unquote neutral zone where displaced Gazans can go. And according to the report, the zone is being readied to absorb 200,000. Egypt emphasized, however, that quote-unquote no refugee may enter its territory beyond the neutral zone. Barrell discusses many more important details, such as the role of the Palestinian Authority resettling Gazans in the neutral zone that apparently the Egyptians and the Americans are in favor of, but Netanyahu may not be. And Politico reported Israel said they could move Palestinians out of the city in 4 weeks, 1.4 million people in 4 weeks, while the Americans said such a migration would require 4 months. Since then, the groups have been, from the Israeli side, the American side, have been working together to find some sort of compromise. It's given. The longer the war goes, which is in Netanyahu's interest, the longer he's likely to remain in office and not face corruption charges that are hanging over his head. There are so many unanswerable questions about the likely Rafah invasion. One thing is certain. The thing that's certain, I'll quote the title of an opinion piece from Gideon Levy, the columnist for Haaretz. What is certain is no victory awaits Israel in Rafah, only more death and destruction.